Welcome to our International Women's Day special episode of Thriving in the Age of Disruption podcast. This year's theme is Embrace Equity. And we're excited to celebrate by sharing inspiring ideas of how we can all work to create a world where women are valued, respected, and empowered. Dr. Ramesh has a very special guest today, Datin Paduka Marina Mahathir, a renowned Malaysian social-political activist and writer. Marina was the 2010 UN Person of the Year in Malaysia for her work in fighting AIDS and named in the 100 Most Inspiring People Delivering for Girls and Women in conjunction with the 100th anniversary of International Women's Day in 2011. Entrepreneurship-wise, Marina is the founder of Zafigo.com, a website dedicated to women travelers, inspired by her mission to encourage women to travel the world. Marina is also a fearless voice for women's rights, gender equality, religious freedom, and justice. The eldest child of Malaysia's longest-serving Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir Mohamad, she has worked tirelessly to break down barriers and pave the way for women to rise and thrive. In this episode, Marina shares her journey, struggles, and triumphs as a woman in the public eye in a patriarchal society. She also discusses with Dr. Ramesh the critical issues that women face today and how we can all work together and embrace equity to empower women and to amplify their voices. So sit back, grab a cup of tea, and join Dr. Ramesh for this personal conversation with one of Malaysia's most outspoken and fascinating voices. Welcome to the Thriving in the Age of Disruption podcast series, Datin Paduka Marina Mahathir. It's our privilege to have you here today. I wanted to start off by asking you to introduce yourself. Please let us know what you do for a living, what keeps you occupied, and what you're passionate about.
Thanks, Ramesh, for having me on this show. I'm Marina Mahathir. I like to call myself a writer, but in fact, I do many, many things, mostly around writing and communication. I've been a journalist, a PR consultant, led NGOs, and I'm still very much involved in activism, particularly for women's rights and human rights in general.
For International Women's Day, what's your hope and wishes for women in 2023?
Well, I think all over the world, women are in crisis. The world is in crisis. There are all sorts of terrible things going on, but women are feeling the impact of it all over the world, whether it is in America, where their reproductive rights are being attacked in really extreme cases like Afghanistan or in places like Iran, and less publicized issues in many other countries where women are really seeing their voices tempered down or being attacked. Here in Malaysia, my organization, Sisters in Islam, we're constantly being attacked, and we're seeing rising conservatism here and all over the world, actually. You know, the first target of attack is always women, regardless of which country, which religion. Women are somehow always the first. There's a lot of issues that women are facing. I think the most important thing is that we all have to understand that these are all our issues. It's not just an Afghan women's issue, Iranian or American women's issue. It's all our issues. Sometimes these things are like a virus. They can spread. Some male-dominated governments see, oh, okay, that works in that country. Maybe I'll try it too. And it goes on and on. And so we have to stand in solidarity with one another. I think that's the most important thing. We have to stand in solidarity. We have to stand up for each other, but without imposing our own views on different people. Like Iranian women, for example, are quite capable of solving their own problem. Look at them, the bravery, these women just going out there, and they just need the moral support from the rest of us, because things can go back. You look at Sudan, where women came out to protest against the government, and they managed to bring down that government. There's a new government completely forgot about all those women. That's something that is not paid attention to as much. We really need to stand up for each other. That's really important.
That's true. Each of us standing in solidarity, we can do what we need to do at our own levels.
So if I'm a boss in an organization, I can look to mentor younger women. Or I'm a junior staff, I can look at collaborating with my other colleagues who are women so that we're not fighting for that same attention, but rather work together. That's actually the key shift that I am also so aware of, because unlike men who have the old boys network, I think women still don't have that same kind of excitement and affinity towards creating a network or a tribe.
It's coming together now more than ever because there are more women out in the workforce in executive positions. And I went to boarding school here, the female equivalent of an elite boys' school here in Malaysia. The boys are very networked, so much so that every Wednesday they'll wear the same colored school tie. They have regular meetings and all that. But women, because in school, even from young, we are not socialized to know that we will need each other later on. We're all smart and we all expected to rise high in whatever we do. Ultimately, we are expected to get married, have kids and all that. And our work life is separate and we won't need each other. Whereas the men, they stay in touch because they may need each other. We are not socialized to do that from young. Mm-hmm. So when we finally start, it's kind of late for some people. But I think there's a growing recognition where people try and keep alumni together because that builds bonds for future.
Definitely, we can do more to develop our own tribes and our networks and keep connected.
Yeah.
And not be transactional, like only when we need a favor, right, to reach out.
Yes, exactly. What I really love doing is writing. I've been writing a column for the Star newspaper for 30 years. And I've had some books published, which are compilations of those columns. Most recently, Penguin Random House published a book of mine, which is a memoir. It's called The Apple and the Tree, which came out in November 2021.
Your recent book, The Apple and the Tree, can you share a little bit more about the inspiration behind the book and how writing that book has altered the way you look at life and what people have said about that?
The Apple and the Tree is a memoir. The subhead is Life as Dr. Mahathir's Daughter. One of the favorite questions people used to ask me is, what is it like to be Dr. M's daughter? So I thought I would answer it once and for all with this book. And I've always wanted to write a book from start to finish, because I've been writing a column all this time, and a column is 800 to 1,000 words. It's not always very satisfying. You can't explore a topic thoroughly. I actually went off to study how to write a book. I went to do my master's in biography and creative nonfiction in the UK. About a year after that, actually during the COVID lockdown, Penguin Random House Singapore approached me and asked if I would write a book exactly on this topic. So that's what I did, and it came out in November 21. It's been a year. It's done fairly well. I was doing a lot of readings, book signings and interviews and everything. I've just been in Dhaka, Bangladesh for the Dhaka Literary Festival, where I talked about the book. And next week I'm going to Dubai for the Emirates Literary Festival, where again I'm talking about the book. So it's been a very, very exciting journey, and the book has allowed me to not just flex my writing muscles, but also it's allowed me to meet a whole lot of people that I don't think I would have had the chance to meet.
Thank you for sharing that, because you can see the richness of that project. Not only did you explore just a topic, but you explored your relationship, your life, right? And being Dr. Mahathir's daughter, which at some point might have been also very personal. So how did you feel writing about some of these things?
Well, it has to be personal, because otherwise it's not interesting, I think, to the reader. But of course, I had to navigate a lot of delicate issues. And, you know, it takes a lot of thinking, because you always have to think of how people closest to you, the people you mention, are going to react. So you want to be authentic, you want to be true to yourself, but you also kind of need to be diplomatic in how you put things. So I think there's a lot of read between the lines.
an entrepreneurial mindset is a very critical mindset to have in this age of disruption. And I define entrepreneurial mindset as one whereby we are being resourceful. That means that when we face a problem, we don't give up. We are able to look at what the problem is, maybe even define it better. Number two is that in the process of looking at the problem, there would be uncertainty and there would be risk, and we are able to deal with that. And lastly, of course, we are creating value, not just for ourselves, but also for the people around us and the different stakeholders. So when I look at your journey and how you've moved from being a journalist to a PR consultant to running NGOs to activism to even writing your book, it's obvious that you have demonstrated entrepreneurial mindset. Anyone can take on an entrepreneurial mindset, but not everyone might want to start and run a business.
I didn't really think of myself as having much of an entrepreneurial mindset. I just look at a problem and try and solve it somehow. That is what I do, whether I'm in an NGO or I'm doing something else. I guess the main example of me being entrepreneurial and starting a business is that I have this travel website called zappigo.com, which aims to provide information for women who are interested in travel to encourage them to have safe and smooth travel. The background of that was that when I was in my NGO working in HIV/AIDS, I used to have to go to meetings. My question every time that I had to go, whether it is to Pakistan or to Kenya or somewhere, is how do I dress? I couldn't find any information. And I realized that travel is very, very gendered, in that women have to think of certain things that men don't really have to worry about. One of them is dress. Because in places that are quite conservative, for instance, like Pakistan, you have to think about what you're wearing. And men don't really. I mean, they can wear a shirt and tie and a jacket and then they're fine. Whereas we have to think about whether our heads need to be covered, how much of our arms can be exposed, that sort of thing. And there are also cultural issues. In some places, men won't shake hands with you. Be prepared for that shock. I've known women who've led delegations to certain places and then were told to leave the room by the men because they couldn't accept a woman as being the head of delegation. So I thought that was a need there, and I just could not find any information. Although there are many travel websites for women, but they are very Western and they're about Western women traveling. Whereas for us, Asian women particularly, I think we face very different issues. So I realized there was a need and I thought it would be great to have a website. Women who travel, they agreed. They said, yeah, they'd like to know. Some of them were in the foreign service, some of them in NGOs, and they were being sent to places like Afghanistan where people brief them on security, but not on dress and culture and things like that. I finally met a friend who knows how to set up websites, and he said, yeah, we can do it. And that's how we started in 2014. And it's 9 years. It's thriving. I have 8 young women working, and they're full of ideas. It's become a go-to site for a lot of people, whether they're in Malaysia or people who are coming to visit Malaysia. We're trying to expand it beyond Malaysia and talk about other countries as well. But yeah, it's really happening and I'm really pleased and proud with it.
That's a great example of an idea. And it came from a day-to-day problem that women face. To have launched it as a business and to have sustained it over the years to having it be thriving at this level is extraordinary. And that's how businesses start. It doesn't have to be an innovative big tech idea.
For a long time, it was a real struggle. And now we're really seeing the fruits of that work. We've had a number of changes of personnel, changes of the look and feel of it. It's just getting better and better. And I'm in for the long haul.
Wonderful. One important thing that has happened, I think, in the last 10 years also, women now have become more interested in traveling alone. They want not just the safety, but also to be appropriate to be able to enjoy whichever country that they go to. So websites like yours will provide incredible information to help people prepare.
When I was young, I kind of did a round the world trip on my own. many, many years ago. And I saved up for it. I planned. This was the days before the internet. So everything was done manually, so to speak. And I had been very sick before that. I had dengue and I'd been very ill. But I was really determined to go. And it was great. I had all sorts of warnings, especially from my mom. I was in New York. It's like, oh, it's a terrifying place and that sort of thing. But I didn't tell her everything. But yeah, I survived it all. I could do it. And I think that this point of Zatigo, that if you do manage to travel safely and smoothly with the tips that we provide, it really uplifts your whole self-confidence. Then it makes you more positive about other things that you can do in your work, in your personal life and everything. It really has a knock-on effect just from doing that.
That's true. I started to think back about the time when I had the opportunity to be on a container ship for about 3 weeks, which went from Singapore to Australia. And I never thought much about it. I was 19 years old, I think, when I did that trip. But looking back now, I think that did shape how I looked at the world and how I could be with certain situations. When you're a 19-year-old and you have to deal with certain situations, then you're ready for the rest of the world and the rest of the things that are going to come at you.
Right. Oh, I didn't think they took passengers.
No, they didn't. It was a prize that I won because I had done a diploma in shipping management and Neptune Orient Lines had given that as their part of the prize, and BA flew us one way and then we came back on the container ship. So it was an extraordinary opportunity. But I tell you, there were times when I would look out into the wide ocean and all I would see is just the sea, right? It was quite frightening looking at just water and water and water, endless. The next topic, maybe an extension of entrepreneurship. Do you have some plans for this travel website in terms of expanding it and raising funds, or are you looking at growing it organically?
I have many aspirations for it. I really would like it to cover all of Asia, which is what we originally intended, really. I'm trying to extend it to the rest of Southeast Asia. Eventually, I hope it will be a community. I hope that there will be Zafigoers everywhere and we can connect people and they can meet each other and it'll become something like, I don't know, Expedia or something. We can arrange tours. That's something I'd like to do in the future. We're attracting interest from other people in the travel industry. For instance, my staff, they get invitations from Tourism Australia and from other organizations to go and visit and do reviews. So we're getting known and they like the fact that our target audience is women. We really are getting a lot more readership, not just in Malaysia, but around the world. I really, really want it to grow bigger. And I'm very happy to have partnerships with other people, anyone who can add value to us or we add value to them. So yeah. Everything is possible.
I love that. So if anyone is listening to this conversation and you want to contribute or you're looking to collaborate, reach out to www.safigo.com.
Yes, absolutely.
Having a crisis-ready mindset is also an important attribute to have in today's world of disruption. I define crisis as any kind of setback that you have to deal with in life. And usually during this setback, you have a turning point. If you take action, either you're going to face death or you're going to move forward. And some of us can freeze and we don't do anything about it. And the decision almost gets made by the circumstance itself. In your own life, how have you dealt with crisis?
It's been a learning curve for me to learn how to deal with crisis. I think in the old days when I was much younger, I tended to sit on things. And then, like you said, it gets decided for me, which is not always the way I wanted it. So I think over time, I've learned to take charge more, like realize that I can do something to get through the crisis, that evading it is not the answer. You know, you have to go through it. And that's the only way you can get the outcome that you really want. And also, it's part of growth, really. I've had some big and small ones, both personal and at work, but I think I've gotten better at it. I'm no longer fearful. If a crisis comes, then okay, I'll just face it. I used to just react when something happens. And nowadays, I'm much calmer. I think meditation helps. More able to see things as they are and see what I can control, what I can do, and then take it from there. I mean, the whole world has been in crisis. I feel like the pandemic has really allowed us to reorder our priorities and see what's really important in life, whether it's personal or in our work and in our more public life, like I have. That's how you build resilience, really, by looking at what's really important in your life. I mean, one of the things I realized during the pandemic is that I don't need a lot of stuff in my life. Having more stuff means having more things to take care of. And that's a burden, actually. That's an ongoing strain. You just sort of discard all the unimportant things and then you have less. I feel so liberated. And similarly, work has changed in my Zafigo office. We're flexible, I guess, with the way we work, even before the pandemic, because we're almost all women. There are some young mothers, so they need time to take care of their kids as well. And so I've been very flexible. After the pandemic, once we got back to work, it's kind of more, I wouldn't say concretized, but it's become the norm now. 3 days in the office and 2 days off. Any 3 days and any 2 days. I only insist that there's one day when everybody is in, because I think we have to keep seeing each other. We have to keep looking at people's faces, especially those we work with, to know how they feel about anything. There is no substitute, really, for real human interaction. And if anything, they've become much more productive. That's why I think Zafigo, for sure, it has gotten so much better. They're much more relaxed because they're not having to think about other things that they have to do and all that. There's always a time and place to do it. For me too, I'm not here 9 to 5, but even if I'm out of the office, doesn't mean I'm not working. I'm just doing it in a different setting, maybe, or taking care of other things that I really need to do. I'm really happy with things the way they are now.
A lot of people have talked about how they have shifted their work styles as a result of COVID. I mean, for ourselves, especially since I run a consulting firm. And in the past, I've never dared to say that we will do our engagement by Zoom. But when we were forced to for 2 years not to be able to travel and have to deliver our work day in, day out through Zoom or virtually, then it became like, okay, we can actually produce a result without having to meet people. But then you still had to, like you said, look for those little ways in which to connect with people, because human beings, you need to create the relationship and you need to connect with them. And so whether it was someone there in Vietnam when we were doing the work who represented us, or we did something that they saw was also akin to what we would have done if we were there face to face. So we need to make those adjustments. I was just wondering though, I mean, what was that key crisis for you where you started to let go of stuff, that you realize that you don't need to evade the situation or worry too much?
I remember waking up on New Year's Day, I think many, many years ago. I was about 35 and feeling miserable and horrible. And I thought, I don't want to spend the rest of my life feeling like this. And therefore, I had to look at what was causing all this. It was very clear to me what was causing it. And basically, it led to a divorce, my first husband, which was a bit of a fight because I didn't want to lose my child. I was very afraid of that. Took all these steps to protect that. And I did it. Took a few years. And then after that, sort of meeting my husband now, and also took a few years before we could get married and have a baby. I had to navigate all this very discreetly because my father is a public figure and I'm sort of semi-public as well. You know, those are added pressures. They're all the hazards of being a public figure, all the hazards of Malaysian politics. Those were probably pivotal moments, and there have been other smaller ones. And I'm still learning to this day how to handle people. I'm very private and I expect other people to be private. Particularly, I don't think I'm always great with people.
What's your advice to young women who aspire to move up in corporate world or in running their businesses in terms of how they can develop their leadership skills?
I think everyone is a potential leader. You just don't always recognize it yourself. I went to boarding school here in Malaysia. Having always been a kind of a follower or just going along with things, I was really entranced by how some of my schoolmates just had natural leadership abilities. They were the first to organize anything. They were the first to lead teams. I thought, wow, how come some people are like that? I would never step out to lead anything. I never thought I could do it. I never thought I had the right to do it. And then later on, when I was put in a situation, particularly when I was asked to chair the Malaysian AIDS Foundation, and I found myself suddenly in a leadership position, I really had to learn in real time how to be a leader. Everyone was looking to me for leadership. And I had to kind of learn on the job. Mm. I don't think I made many major mistakes, but I realized that it's a real balance, at least for women, between leading and allowing the space for the people who are looking up to you to also voice their views. Those 12 years that I was at the Malaysian AIDS Council, I can vouch that the me at the beginning and the me at the end was not the same at all. I grew up so much. I mean, I was thrown into the deep end completely, and I had to learn on the job. A lot of it was by listening and learning and being open to what other people say. I realized that I always had to come with something to the table, but had to be prepared for it to be shut down or amended or whatever. That's the way it is. A lot of young women, I think, can learn that lesson, but that environment has to be conducive. That's where I think women who are already in leadership positions need to play that mentoring role. Because if a lot of young women are put in situations where they're mostly men and they don't see anyone else like them in that role, they're going to find it hard going and they're going to find it maybe even oppressive. The space for them to contribute is not going to be there unless they get really, really aggressive, and then they're going to face a pushback. I've been very, very lucky in that all my mentors have been female. All my bosses, my early bosses have been female, and they've all been great nurturing women. I see a lot of talented young women these days with a lot of potential, and I really place a lot of hopes on them to become our leaders now. Actually, they don't have to wait for the future. We don't have time to wait for the future. I mean, they have to step up and lead now. Look at Greta Thunberg, for example.
Correct, yes.
What did she do? She just sat in front of the Swedish parliament or whatever with a sign. And as leadership, she just decided to do it. I see lots of young women who are able to do that. They just step up. And that's it. One of the myths about leadership is that you need to have a lot of followers before you can be a leader. And I think what Greta has shown us is that, no, you just lead. And others will find you and follow you.
That's right. Piggybacking on your idea, it's more of leading yourself, right?
Yes.
And that's the key point about leading, that you learn to lead yourself. Because often where we feel in our leadership is that we think it's about others following us, but yeah, we forget that we come to the table ready with something. We are there open. And all that is part of leading ourselves. You mentioned that you had great mentors. How did it happen? Did you proactively go looking for them?
I've been really, really lucky in that my first job, I worked at a women's magazine. And the editor was a woman. And I talk about her in my book, actually, where I said that she hadn't known I was coming. Her boss, the general manager of the whole company, employed me without telling her. And he's a man, of course. So I was kind of foisted on her. And the first time I met her, she looked really unfriendly and I was really scared. And I thought, oh no, she thinks I'm here because of favoritism or whatever. But I just got down to work. To me, all I wanted to do was write, and to work, to be working for a magazine was, to me, it was like, wow. And eventually she saw that I was a real worker, a real writer. Then she began to appreciate that I had plenty to contribute, and she was really, really a very nurturing editor. She really pushed me out, and I just learned. I think now women who are in top positions, they're more aware of their role in bringing up other women. We need more going up the ladder. So many women before look down and find nobody else there to take their place.
That's right. Where are you in your spiritual journey?
And it's a difficult question. Well, spiritual life is very much related to everything else that's going on. And it's whether you are happy with things or not. If things are not going right in my environment, then I think my spirituality drops.
That's such a simple way to gauge that.
In a way, nurturing your spirituality needs time and space. When you're busy running around trying to solve this or that issue, then that kind of takes a back seat. Because the work I do in my current activism, which is about human rights and particularly Muslim women's rights, I have to think about the spiritual dimension to it all. Our work at Sisters is really about how laws and policies are influenced by religion. So we have to kind of question, like, what religion, whose religion? And if these laws and policies are unjust, there's something wrong here, because all religions are brought to us to make our lives better or worse. When you start reflecting on why is there dissonance, you start separating the true faith and beliefs with human-made laws and policies and things. And then you start seeing what you really believe in. And if you believe in justice, in equality and all that, then you have to turn back to the original source and realize that all the trouble you're seeing is actually human-made. The answer to that is to go back to the origins, you know. We're all meant to do good. And the rules are simple, actually. Be good to other people. Practice charity. That sort of thing. I'm going to Dubai next week for the Emirates Literary Festival, and they've put me on a panel with two very learned men, Reza Aslan, who's an Islamic scholar and has written several books. He's an Iranian-American. The other was someone I didn't know at all. So I was a bit afraid. I was quite inhibited by the idea of this panel and decided to read up what he's written. And it's a very simple book. This man has written, he's from the UAE. He's actually the current Emirati ambassador to France, I think. He's got this mind that is so open and progressive. And basically, he's written a book to his son, trying to give the son advice on how to navigate this world, all its many challenges, and be a good Muslim. And his definition of a good Muslim isn't just about praying five times a day and fasting and giving alms. It's more than that, you know. It's about being just to other people. It's about looking after people who have less than you. It's just wonderful.
It all boils down for you about being connected to yourself, to your higher self, to the universe, to everything, right? Because then you're part of that system and you're whole.
Yeah.
And when there is a breakdown and there's disconnection, then you see the stresses and the injustice, right?
Exactly.
So do you think it's possible for us to live a simple life in today's world?
I think it depends on what you mean by simple.
And what is simple for you?
I think simple for me is to just be able to wake up in the morning with a clear conscience and to carry on and do my work, be nice to people and have people be nice to me. I think that will be a simple life for me. But I don't think I'm simple in the sense that I have my stuff. I have my phone that is attached to my hand. I have all these different things going on. But to be able to navigate life and feel at peace, to me, that would be a simple life. It's not complicated at all.
So that's interesting, because I think you made that distinction between that piece that you have control over, which is from your own perspective or your relationship to simplicity. And that's really about having no baggage. What you called it is a clear conscience. Have no baggage, or you have let go. So you're not burdened by whatever that happened yesterday and you start afresh.
Exactly. Being able to get up every day and feel like, okay, I can handle this. No big issues. That to me would be when I can say my life is simple.
That's right. And then, of course, there's the other piece, which is that you've got roles to play and responsibility. And often the simplicity there is not within your control, because there are things that you have to do, and it's what you have to do. And that's it.
For women, you know, we are wives, we are mothers, daughters, we are sisters.
Yeah.
And sometimes more than that to lots of other people.
Yes.
And juggling those roles can be exhausting, right? So I just feel blessed that not all those people need me at the same time.
So if you had to use a couple of words to describe the state of thriving, what would you use for yourself? When are you thriving? When are you flourishing as a human being?
I think personally, I'm flourishing when I'm writing. There's nothing I would love more than to be able to just sit and write every day. It's a need to put something down or paper. Sometimes it's the physical act of writing. And when I have the time to do that, that's when I think I'm happiest. And I almost feel whole like that. I'm thriving when I do that. A few years ago, I took up journaling. And although it's not going to lead to a book or anything, the fact that I do it every day gives me the sense of satisfaction, because I do it at the end of the day. It's a nice roundup to my day. What has happened in the day, it just calms me down too. It's quite meditative. And that, I think, makes me able to go on to the next day.
Yeah.
So I feel like it helps me thrive in that way.
Wow. Marina, I want to thank you for an exciting conversation that I've had with you. Definitely there's been food for thought, and I'm going to go back and reflect on some of the things that we discussed. I hope you've enjoyed the time together as well.
I have. Thank you very much. It's one of the more substantive conversations I've had in an interview. So thank you. This was very enjoyable.
Thank you for joining Dr. Ramesh and Marina today. We hope you've enjoyed listening to Marina's personal journey on overcoming struggles and finding growth. We'd love for you to share this podcast with your family, friends, and colleagues. Let's all come together to embrace equity and build a more inclusive society where every woman has the opportunity to thrive. If you're interested to learn more about the entrepreneurial mindset, check out Dr. Ramesh's book, The Big Jump into Entrepreneurship 2.0. Simply click on the Amazon link provided in the podcast description. In addition, make sure you follow Dr. Ramesh on LinkedIn so that you'll get the latest insights from her and our amazing podcast guests. Thank you once again for joining us today. Happy International Women's Day.